Hello and welcome. You are listening to the Civitas On Air podcast, where we bring to you informed debate and discussion. Hello and welcome to Civitas On Air. My name is Kerry Longhurst, and today I'm going to be leading the podcast called Shaping Europe, Security, Resilience and EU Enlargement. And to talk about the subjects involved in this, I'm joined by four students from Collegium Civitas. Kamil Novak from Poland.
Hello everyone.
Diana Prushinska from Ukraine.
Hey guys.
Milana Bagdasarian from Armenia.
Hey, good morning.
Aslan Soleymanov from Uzbekistan.
Hello.
Thanks all of you for joining me today. I should also say that this podcast is also the result of discussions that we've been having with students from the European Humanities University in Lithuania and Tbilisi State University in Georgia as part of the Jean Monnet module, Debating Europe, Internal, External Perspectives. So, Shaping Europe, Security, Resilience and EU Enlargement is quite a mouthful, but we're going to try and talk about issues that are relevant for today's European integration and also some questions to do with the near future. And of course, this discussion is taking place against the backdrop of ongoing war in Ukraine. But let's just pick apart that title a little bit. Shaping Europe, well, we know what that means. Security, we kind of know what that means. And EU enlargement, we definitely know what that means. But how about this term resilience, which is quite a buzzword in today's international relations? Kamil, what does resilience mean to you?
So I would say it's a sort of a capacity to recover from some unexpected events, maybe even thrive despite challenges. So I would say it definitely involves adaptability.
Thank you. Aslan, how about you? Resilience, what does that spark inside
you? Well, actually, Kamil actually picked up a great point about being able to adapt the organizational structures and activities when an organization is facing a certain threat that we're facing right now, for example, with the war in Ukraine. So for me, resilience is, again, being able to foresee, also implement some measures when it comes to mitigating a certain crisis that a political bloc or any country or society in general is facing.
So from your perspective, it's linked to the notion of security, but it's not just about hard security and having the capabilities. It's about broader society's capacity to bounce back after external trauma.
Yes, exactly. So I think that this is kind of like a cohesive framework, I would say, for adjusting everything, not just security, but also the structure and the code of conduct of an organization in general and society in general.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think we can talk about resilience at the level of the individual, families, communities, regions, states, etc., etc. Diana, anything that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would like to add that resilience is actually the first step to peace and one of its important components, to be honest.
I think, therefore, from what we've said, it's not surprising that resilience has become this buzzword when we think about European integration, when we think about relations with the wider Europe, European security, transatlantic security, etc., etc. I still think that from kind of my academic point of view, the concept needs a bit more kind of fleshing out, and maybe in the future, as young researchers, you could think about that. But I think for me, certainly, resilience shouldn't be just about bouncing back. It should be about the capacity to kind of bounce forwards. And I think that should be the paradigm in which we look at the evolution of Europe and the evolution of Eastern Europe as well. But let's get back to the so-called script and the kind of issues that I'd like to hear your views on today. And the first kind of cluster I thought we could think about was that to do with European security. Now, once upon a time when we thought about European security, it was primarily about NATO. But in the meantime, over the last 20, 30 years or so, the EU has slowly but surely gained a much more security-related set of capacities or identity, and it's definitely become a force for stability across Europe. Aslan, I know that you're a keen follower of all things NATO. We've recently had the NATO summit. In the framework of European security, what are your main lessons drawn from the NATO summit?
Well, to put it simply, I think that the summit in the context of the European security was a failure. So this is it exactly proves the point that the European security is not a matter of NATO anymore, but the European Union has taken a more and more assertive stance in this. So I think that what we're witnessing in the recent decade is that there are some other organizations, but primarily the European Union, that are slowly but surely, as you said, are taking the role away from NATO when it comes to ensuring a collective approach to security. So what we witnessed in the recent years is that we're seeing a more and more independent, let's say, pan-European mechanisms that take care of security and defense in the continent independently from the United States. So definitely when it comes to the recent kind of like a critical point, critical juncture, so the NATO summit that you've just mentioned, I think that the European policymakers have definitely learned the lesson, and we're likely to see a more and more assertive role of the European Union in security. So kind of like a continuation of what we're already witnessing within the last, let's say, 5 or 10 years, for example, with the establishment of the European political community. So definitely considering the fact that no fruitful outcome, especially when it comes to the war in Ukraine, has been produced by the recent NATO summit, I think that we're very likely to see that some European Union mechanisms and European Union kind of like mandated frameworks are likely to enhance their capabilities in the future, because there will be literally no substitution and no organization that would be able to ensure successful functioning of security and defense mechanisms, especially considering what we're witnessing in the United States right now.
Thank you. It's interesting that you talk about the EU becoming more potentially effective or a more vocal or important player in European security. I completely agree. But of course, the EU is strong politically, very strong economically, but on the military front, it doesn't have such a profile. I know that, Milana, you've been thinking and doing some research on the EU's more specific role in the security field in the eastern neighbourhood countries. Tell us a bit about what it's been doing in Moldova, for example.
So basically, EU held a peacekeeping mission in Moldova, and recently, due to the Armenian president seeking for help from EU, they agreed to hold this operation in the border of Nagorno-Karabakh to basically control both Armenian and Azerbaijan border and to prevent like the further war and further bloodshed. But unfortunately, right now, due to the situation of Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, there is no actions coming from EU, and unfortunately during the European Council they didn't agree on any decisions. However, on the other hand, United States are trying to negotiate with Azerbaijan president, and they're trying to reach out to him and find a compromise in the field of the signed peace agreement. But we still have all hopes that the situation gonna be improved sooner than later.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like the EU is again trying to step into the neighbourhood and have some novel frameworks or actions to try and ease the situation. Aslan, maybe you want to add to that?
Yeah, there is one very interesting aspect about Moldova. It seems like the European Union is the only alternative for the country right now, because we're witnessing a very, very enhancingly assertive stance of Russia in the region, despite its military failures in the region. But Moldova is constitutionally neutral, so technically they cannot apply for NATO membership, but at the same time they're still looking for security guarantees because this country is extremely vulnerable to the Russian threat right now. While their constitution prohibits them from joining the North Atlantic Organization Treaty, they're not technically prohibiting themselves to join the European Union. So if the European Union will become more assertive when it comes to security and defense, this will be a very, very plausible option for Moldova, because it will not technically directly provoke some actors that may be against the NATO's accession of Moldova, while at the same time it will be able to ensure some security guarantees and to grant some security guarantees to Moldova.
It's interesting because Moldova is often seen as one of the key examples of a state trying to improve its resilience, going back to the point we made earlier. But certainly NATO membership isn't on the card for Moldova in the way that it is, was, or might be when it comes to Ukraine. What would be the kind of main pros and cons of, going back a bit more on NATO maybe, of Ukraine being a NATO member? I mean, can you, Camille or Diana?
There are actually a lot of pros in context of Ukraine being one of NATO's members. For example, there will be a NATO member at the Russian border, and Russia's aggressive actions actually would be prevented, and the Russian aggression won't be expanded to different countries further. For example, if we're speaking about Moldova that was mentioned before, then it won't be as vulnerable as is it right now.
Milena, please come in on that.
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for this opportunity. So I would love to add that Ukraine is a post-Soviet country, right? And from all of them, it's one of the most developed countries in terms of the human rights, in terms of the rule of law. And if we would see the corruption rate there, we can see it's very successful and this rate is very low. So from my perspective, Ukraine has a great potential becoming a part of EU because it's very developed and it has a rule of law and also human rights, and it's very democratic country, I would say. And of course, we should not forget about the location of this country, that basically EU would have like full potential to secure its borders with Russia. And also we should take into consideration that Ukraine is one of the largest exporter of seeds. And yes, so it has great potential to become part of EU.
We'll come on to the issue of EU enlargement a little bit later. You've painted a quite a kind of positive, rosy picture of Ukraine's development, of the fact that you said that corruption has been improved, et cetera, et cetera. But I saw some other members in the group kind of being a little bit more doubtful about that. So Milena, you painted quite an encouraging and a positive picture of Ukraine's development, and certainly we'll look into the question of EU enlargement and membership a little bit later. But just to kind of steer it back to the issue of NATO membership, as you know from the previous NATO summit, Zelensky was not particularly happy with the result. This was seen as a half-baked proposal, membership possibly when, who knows, and as we know, giving a time frame, a timeline of membership is really, really important. Given that there has been improvement in terms of anti-corruption and resilience in the country to some degree, but given the fact that the country is at war and has an undefined border because of Russia's presence and takeover, what can this mean for NATO membership in concrete terms? Camille.
Well, obviously, it would be very difficult for Ukraine to enter NATO right now, but I would want to highlight that Ukraine's army is probably very well trained and the only army that has so much experience in real combat. So it would be a great asset for NATO, I think.
Yeah, Diana, please come in on that.
Yeah, despite the fact that there is war there and it's kind of lowering the chance for Ukraine to join NATO, there is a situation in Cyprus, for example, where it's called civil war between Turkish and Greek parts of Cyprus. So actually Ukraine still has the chance to join the NATO, but unfortunately has quite low diplomatic power. Even though the military power is strengthening, it's still lack of diplomacy is an issue for Ukraine and its future.
So the fact that you have two NATO members, i.e. Greece and Turkey, in a conflict is a good precedent for considering Ukraine's membership. It shows it can be done. It shows that...
Actually, it shows that there are different issues happening in the world. Unfortunately, there are some cases that are inevitable. So, and it shows the future that the conflict might be resolved soon. So that's why it's actually, it's technically increasing the chance for Ukraine to join the NATO.
I hope so, at some point. lots of barriers in the way. Before we move on to a different set of questions, but still related, I wanted to bring up a subject which academically, but also policy-wise, is really salient right now. Because we talk about security in economic terms, military terms, and these more traditional categories of what security is about. But there's been a definite semi-shift, I would say, way towards a different paradigm and way of thinking about security. And people have been referring to a feminist foreign policy. And probably you know that a number of states around the world, in Europe but outside Europe too, have adopted what they've called a feminist foreign policy agenda. Now, just to say before people start rolling their eyes, this is not just about promoting women. It's not just about putting women higher up the kind of pyramid of salience, let's say. It's a whole about bringing a whole range of issues to center stage. For me, this is a really interesting way of thinking about EU as a security actor. It seems that it might be the kind of institution very fit and suited to pursuing a feminist foreign policy. What do you think about that? How would you respond, Aslan?
So yeah, I think that the problem with naming this particular approach that you're like the one that you're referring to as feminist, so that this is the problem, because it's not just about gender equality, as you've mentioned, but it's about facilitating and motivating reforms in those nations that are aspiring to become the European Union members. And I think that the issue is critical in some countries, like for example, if we take Georgia. So I think that we should not discard this concept, because those reforms that are implemented by those aspirant member nations are critical for their accession into the organization. So, and also, there's been some research that actually proves the point that those countries that support gender equality and have those mechanisms in place that support, it's not just about gender equality, but also about the fair conditions and fair livability of ethnic minorities. Those countries are peaceful and they're able to facilitate the resolutions of the conflicts that they're witnessing. So I think that it is important for both the European Union enlargement and also in turn for the resolution of those frozen conflicts that we're witnessing in Georgia and Moldova, for example.
Yeah, I think inserting elements of that feminist foreign policy into the development of the EU's relations, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Moldova or any other third countries, to be honest, really makes sense, because, you know, equality equals peace, as you referred to, greater stability. So it absolutely should be at the forefront, especially when we look at rebuilding Ukraine as well. Anyone else want to contribute to that issue of feminist foreign policy? Milana, please.
I want to agree with my colleague Arslan, and I also want to mention that from my perspective, equality is the most important sign of stability and economical development, because if we would look on the countries that have equal human rights, that not depending on the gender or race or nationality, we could see that their economical development much, much further than countries that are still developing in this field. So that's why equality brings stability and greater opportunities, not only in the terms of human rights and rule of law, but also in economical developments and perspective.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. Diana, let me hear what you've got to say.
I would absolutely agree with Milana, and not only would it bring like economical development, but also social development, because usually people even don't really think and don't even have a single thought like what gender of person is in front of them. Just like all the people are usually treated equally or by their life achievements.
Thank you. That's a nice kind of link into another set of issues and questions that I think we should talk about, which relate more directly to the theme of EU enlargement. Just to give a brief recap, shortly after the war started last year in Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia both made a formal application to become EU member states. Now, in the case of Ukraine and Moldova, the EU considered the application and responded positively. And as a result of that, since June last year, both Moldova and Ukraine are official candidate states for membership. It's not going to happen overnight, obviously, but it's a really important political symbol, which has been received favourably, I would say, across the whole of the EU. At the same time, Georgia has been given a European perspective, which means it's still on the waiting list, but it really fell short of the candidate status, mainly because of problems with the rule of law and democracy. And if anyone's following Georgian politics, you can see that occurring on a day-to-day basis. So seems that, you know, compared to the situation 2 years ago, when it was just the Western Balkans countries, Albania and Montenegro, etc., in line to become members, we have at least two states which are part of Europe, for sure, Ukraine and Moldova, but still quite different to EU member states in some ways. And the question really now that I'd like to raise is, okay, we can all accept that both Ukraine and Moldova and Georgia have a place at the EU table sooner or later, but is there a need right now to have a speedier route into the European Union? Should Ukraine and Moldova be told that absolutely, you know, we can loosen the criteria because we see the geopolitical need for you to become members more quickly? Diana, tell me what you think about that.
Yeah, for Ukraine and Moldova, I guess there should be a faster way to join the European Union, because for them, if like mostly it means about security, and this would solve like half of issues in those countries, and mostly in Ukraine due to Russia's invasion. And from that perspective, there won't be any further threats to the Ukraine's security, at least officially. And if there will be any more attempts to get the Ukrainian area, then it would mean the security issue for the European Union. So Russia would not risk. I guess so.
Milana, please continue.
I may disagree with Diana. From my perspective, Moldova and Ukraine shouldn't be given the special conditions, because it may jeopardize the other countries' situation, because there are countries that applied much, much earlier and they're still waiting. And if European Union gonna loosen up their condition, it's gonna mean that the quality of acceptance rate gonna be lower and more countries would be able to get into. And that's why I think it should be security issues, economical and democracy issues should be raised, and that they should be very strict in the terms of choosing countries that could get inside.
So the criteria for joining shouldn't be weakened or some special conditions to be given to these two countries. I think there are good reasons for accepting both sides of the argument, but Arslan, you wanted to add to this maybe.
Yeah, so I have an even more negative stance to this, and this is a bit controversial, but I would say that facilitated acceptance of Georgia and Ukraine into the European Union and also to NATO at this extent will mean the end of the alliance, will mean the end of the Union, because both the European Union and NATO have prided themselves as kind of like safekeepers of values and safekeepers of standards that countries are agreeing to follow. So if we are going to lower those standards and accept those countries, regardless of their still evident inability to comply with the corruption standards, with the human rights issue and everything, then it will mean the end of the alliance, because the European Union will lower its stances, and it's going to kind of like provoke a tendency where we're going to see that more and more countries will probably be accepted on the same conditions of, let's say, Moldova and Ukraine in the future. And eventually the standards of the European Union and its mechanisms will be, as Milana just said, jeopardized. And also we're very likely to see kind of like a conflict and maybe even a crisis in case of a facilitated expansion of the European Union and acceptance of those countries, because there are some nations, just as Milana mentioned, in the Balkans and Turkey as well, that will probably be not that happy when it comes to acceptance of some nations in a facilitated way, let's say, because yes, Ukraine is right now there under the invasion. It's also the Moldova that has this frozen conflict, but I don't think that this would be a good reason, because this will mean jeopardizing the mechanisms and also putting the entire security of both the European Union and NATO at risk.
But isn't there a moral dimension to this? You know, both EU and NATO have played roles in the past, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and you know, they have used enlargement to for geopolitical reasons, you know, return to Europe, etc., etc. So maybe we can set aside those conditions for the moment, but monitor them, but to open the doors on a kind of moral basis too. Yeah, let me please respond to that briefly.
Yeah, certainly there are some moral aspects that we need to consider, but I think that when it comes to ensuring the entire existence and ensuring the successful functioning of the alliance, we should put those moral aspirations not completely aside, but we should also take into account some very real and functional, let's say, conditions in the situation when it comes to EU enlargement. Because, yeah, you mentioned a very important point about the European Union enlargement and NATO enlargement in the context of bringing some states back into the European orbit, in a sense. So I think that you were referring to countries of Central Europe and Baltics in particular. So the Baltics were the post-Soviet states. They were accepted, obviously, on the condition that they need to be back in the European orbit. But also, like, I'm working on the thesis right now, and I'm seeing that the scope of reforms that those countries have accomplished within a course of like 10-15 years. So when it comes to NATO, let's say, like, if the Central European nations were accepted in 1999 during another round of NATO enlargement, and then they were accepted to the European Union in 2004. But they were accepted, yes, obviously for a reason that they need to be back to Europe, but also because of the reforms that they have facilitated, especially when it comes to corruption, human rights, and also the issues of ethnic minorities.
So Diana, I'm sure you've got a slightly different take on this.
Yeah, because I have a question. Like Arslan mentioned before, that European Union might lower their standards in case they accept Moldova and Ukraine. I have a question, like, why Ukraine and Moldova when we have an attempt to high up their standards? I mean, special workshops, for example, of European parliamentary practices, for example, like, why should not Ukraine and Moldova try to attempt to high up their standards in order to become European Union members? Or if they already become European Union members, they would have a motivation to change their domestic and foreign policies, security issues, and etc.
I think history shows that certainly when the EU says to a country, you've met the basic criteria and you can now become a candidate state, this is one of the most important impulses for a country to make those democratic, rule of law, economic related reforms that will build a domestic consensus to get the country ready for membership. And that makes me kind of want to turn to my Polish colleague and to hear perhaps your views on how this looks from Warsaw.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say my views are representative of all Polish people. What I wanted to stress out is that there are already various divides within the European Union between countries of in the past that were part of Eastern Bloc and the Western Union and the Western part of Europe. And if we add to that Moldova and Ukraine, there is a high chance, as you mentioned, that they can higher up their standards and be very pro-European, pro-unity, but it can also create various divides within European Union.
I just guess that Ukraine and Moldova would not have enough power to, like, show and expand their rules within the European Union, so they will have to play by the rules that belong to European Union.
I suppose the other side of the argument is that if we don't consider, let's call it, a special path into the European Union, you know, what's going to happen? Isn't the scenario a hell of a lot worse and more damaging to the Union overall and integration and resilience and solidarity overall if we bat this membership question further out of the field? Arslan, you're shaking your head. I'm really keen to hear what you want to say.
Yeah, so I just wanted to go back to some points that we're discussing before. So especially when it comes to, let's say, hiring the standards in countries like Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, we're witnessing it. We're actually witnessing it since 2008. Obviously, there's been a huge progress, especially when it comes to Ukraine. Like, literally 6 years after the first invitation to the alliance, not informal invitation to the alliance, when it comes to NATO, for example, Ukraine had a revolution where they basically overthrew the corrupt government. And this is kind of, I would say, critical point when it comes to the Ukrainian people's willingness to abandon their post-Soviet corrupt, let's say, mindset and actually pursue a path of the European membership. But still, unfortunately, it doesn't deny the fact that there are some issues that are critical and that need to be resolved. So again, in Moldova and in Ukraine, we're witnessing a conflict. And yes, maybe there should be there should be some special conditions to those countries. But until this conflict is resolved, in order for us not to jeopardize the security situation, I think it would be fair to consider that the governments of Moldova, Ukraine, and Georgia need to be motivated to resolve those conflicts, obviously through peaceful means, as the North Atlantic Treaty says, for example, as the European Union Charter also says. I think that it's very important to motivate those nations to resolve those issues, like the Baltic countries have made in the 90s when, with some special conditions and legislations for ethnic Russian minorities that they had. But in Ukraine, unfortunately, we're seeing a different situation. So there is one critical point in 2017. Like, there is a NATO Commission and the European Union Commission in Ukraine. They issued some recommendations when it comes to helping ethnic minorities. But still, in 2017, we witnessed a situation where there was a language law that was passed in Ukraine, which basically prohibited education, like, for most subjects in Russian language. Would actually provoked the entire security situation and arguably led to the invasion in the future, because it helped Russia to manage this perception management campaigns and everything.
Let me just jump into that. But, you know, you mentioned the Baltic states sorting out to some degree the minority questions and conflict resolution. And there were other examples across Central Europe where difficult minority questions, regional conflicts were overcome. Weren't they in part overcome in the context of EU membership? You know, these countries were told, if you want to become a member, you have to, sound more simple, sort it out, basically. And membership perspective, a date, a roadmap, was really a very strong impulse, if not the main impulse, to get the main stakeholders to deal with these questions. So you can look at it from both sides. But I've got two members of the panel here who would like to speak. Just, if you can just make your comments quite quickly, then we'll move on to something else. So, Milena.
First of all, we should not forget what this European Union is. And of course, it is democracy, it's rule of law, human rights. But besides that, it's moral aspirations. And in the situation of Ukraine, they wouldn't be able to settle everything down by themselves. And they need help. They need military help. They need protection. And of course, they need recognition among European countries. So that's why I think it's very hard question, and there is no right answer in this. But we should be more human, and we should understand both perspectives, and we should treat this question with respect and also take into consideration the moral aspirations.
Thank you. Let me just hand over to Diana for a final few words on this particular issue.
I agree absolutely with Milana and Arslan, and I also like to add the fact that unfortunately most of progressive people who have European views, unfortunately they leave Ukraine, they migrate all over the world and they leave Ukraine, so there is a question like if there will be progressive people left in Ukraine, and if there will be a place and there will be initiative people to rule the country by European policy.
That's a really important, very practical question too. Let me just twist now and turn into, again, a related set of issues. We've mentioned before the struggles to do with the rule of law and democracy in Eastern countries and how this is another factor shaping Europe. And I think we can all agree that the condition of the rule of law, the state of democracy, is really critical, critical underpinnings to making a country and making a society resilient or not. And as we know, rule of law and democracy are two of the most fundamental criteria and factors of EU membership, so it can't be ignored. We can talk about getting constitutions ready, the legal statute books of countries and their readiness for EU membership. But there are lots of other issues as well. I mean, what about social rights? What about political rights of citizens? What about LGBTQI+? In a lot of these countries in Central Europe as well, including Poland, the EU has often been blamed, let's say, for the export of what's often been called kind of gender ideology or something. How real are these issues in Europe, would you say? Aslan?
I think that the issue is definitely exaggerated, and what we're seeing is that many of those narratives in the aspirant European Union countries, aspirant European Union members and also NATO members, many of those narratives are the exact result of Russia's perception management campaigns and propaganda. So the issue with ethnic minorities and LGBT and the rule of law and everything like that is not something that is propagated by the European Union exclusively. Like, again, if we take a look at the Charter of the United Nations, if we also take a look at the narratives that the United States government is propagating, for example, and also some other nations, it's not just exclusively the EU concept. And again, it's related to reforms, and some of the issues that are raised in those, let's say, positive narratives are actually customary in a sense, because many of them, again, are mentioned in the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. And I think that this is a part of the global phenomena, and eventually it is an inevitable process for those countries to implement those reforms, because otherwise they will be isolated, because we cannot also neglect the aspect of, let's say, commercial actors stepping into the game. Because right now, there is this very, very popular concept of corporate social responsibility. And if those countries fail to implement some reforms related to gender equality, related to climate and the rule of law, simply they will not get a sufficient flow of investment in order for them either to pursue development, or also in this matter to for their power elites to kind of enrich like each other. So I think that this is an inevitable process, and those countries will have to agree with that, because it's necessary for their survival, in a sense, in an economic sense.
So there's a very strong economic dimension as well. It's not just about norms and ideology.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, to be honest, I guess that Ukraine and Moldova would have to accept anti-discrimination policy, and they will have to accept the equality between different people of different gender, life views, orientation, lifestyle. Like, they would have to accept equality policy for sure.
Camille, please.
Yeah, I would say that I agree with you, because when it comes to things such as this civil society, human rights, LGBTQ issues, they may be frowned upon in Moldova or in Ukraine, but...
Or in Poland.
In Poland as well, yeah, of course. But still, other cultural incentives, economic incentives offered by the EU are overwhelming. So I would say that they would nullify this dissatisfaction.
So in this idea, as we've been talking about shaping Europe, do you think that the EU should have a role and should concern itself with this promotion of anti-discrimination? Or should it just, you know, leave countries and societies to their own volition? Milena?
I would say that promotion is a most important factor, because only due to the soft power of EU, this result could be achieved through educational purposes, through mitigational purposes, and through diplomacy. Because unfortunately right now, Russian soft power is still very strong, especially in post-Soviet countries. And I would say even in Hungary, unsurprisingly. And yeah, and that's why they should fight back. They should show resilience towards Russian soft power, because unfortunately right now I would say Russia winning in this field, because its power is very proficient and it's been used for years, and that's why they have such high level of experience and skills and that. So that's why European Union should take actions and further steps into developing and promoting these values in other countries.
And my understanding is that the part of the effectiveness of Russia's soft power and messaging is because it relies upon the structure of, you know, media and mass communication in these countries, which are very well geared, and the structure of ownership to facilitating Russian messages in that way. I completely agree with you. Diana, anything more on this issue?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with Milena that in case of Hungary, European Union, they failed in case of soft power, and just there should be at least a little bit more promotion of European soft power. And you should also refer to Ukraine and Moldova, because those countries still have kind of some little issues of Russia's influence and the influence of Russian soft power. Not much, but still there are some cases.
We've had such an interesting and wide-ranging discussion, and thanks everyone for devoting the time and to devoting the brain power to this in what is a very difficult situation. Most of you are from that Eastern neighborhood region. And I know that these issues are might be academic for me, but they're very real for you. So thanks for contributing. Shaping Europe is the title of the podcast, and it's brought up so many issues, security, resilience, and EU enlargement, which are all very much interconnected as well. One conclusion or one finding that I would draw from this is that the idea of a multi-speed Europe is increasingly relevant again. A multi-speed Europe, cores and peripheries, is something which is bobbed in and out of discussions on European integration academically and in policy terms for decades actually. But it seems to me, with you know the history of hindsight, that this idea of a multi-speed Europe, a less maybe coherent EU or form of integration, is perhaps more relevant and possible and salient than it ever has been before. I'm going to ask each of you just to provide me with a very short, crisp, informed answer as regarding the question whether a multi-speed Europe is inevitable and whether it's actually quite a good thing. Arslan, what's your view on this, multi-speed Europe?
Yes, I would definitely say that it is inevitable because, like, based on everything that we've discussed, those countries are reforming, so the process will definitely take place in the future. And obviously, it is a good thing because it contributes to the regional security and the well-being of the citizens that reside in those countries.
Camille?
Yes, I think I agree with Arslan that it is a process and it is inevitable, but it is not necessarily the end. It is sort of depending on how European Union will adapt to having more members. I think new solutions will be worked out eventually.
So a more kind of a la carte approach to European integration and enlargement. Diana, multi-speed Europe, is it a good thing?
I would absolutely agree with Arslan and Camille, and I would also say that, of course, it's an inevitable thing, and actually, just like the more states join the European Union, the more flexible the laws and the rules will be to join and to for the countries to exist in general.
Milana?
For me, multi-speed Europe is pretty difficult and challenging process. And I think that right now all European countries should work harder together, have the same approach to different external threats, and they should be in line with their values and goals. But of course, it is a good thing because new countries means development, new ideas and new policies.
Exactly. So thanks everyone for those final words. I think it's clear to me as well that the diversity, the growing number of actors involved, the conflicts, whether they be live conflicts and war, or whether they be the range of frozen conflicts on Europe's periphery, the divergences between Western European countries, Central European, EU member states, the Baltics, the Balkans, Turkey, there are so many issues and challenges on the European Union's agenda right now that somehow loosening and being more pragmatic towards conceptualizing a multi-speed Europe might be the only way, in fact, that we can all proceed more or less in uniform. And I don't think this needs to be some kind of Thatcherite dream of breaking up core Europe, but it just means a way of coping with, in a collective way, all those different challenges, but also the opportunities which are confronting the EU and EU countries and European citizens right now. So if we were to return to the initial question, shaping Europe, it seems like a multi-speed approach is the most common sense way of proceeding. So thanks everyone for joining us this morning in Civitas On Air. This is the final podcast from the Jean Monnet module this year, but we'll certainly be back in the not too distant future with other important and interesting topics to talk about. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Civitas On Air. We cover current and important political and social topics. Our work is produced by researchers and students from Collegium Civitas together with Radio Palace. Please subscribe to our podcast by visiting your favourite streaming service like Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And do stay tuned for the next episode.